Hi, and welcome to revisionmedia.org with me tonight. Live from London, I'm Paul Stevenson, coming through here live, as I say, from London, England, through till 9 p.m. in the UK. That's 2 till 3 Central Time and 3 p.m. till 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I hope I find you all well, as well as can be in these rather depressing times. I've got an interview tonight. I pre-recorded recently with Mark Collett. I'm a big fan of Mark. I think he's a guy with great integrity, and he had his head screwed on, and I've enjoyed his content over the years. He's one of those guys where I've just, like, you know, kind of felt that there's very, very little I disagree with him on in his general worldview about what we're dealing with today, whether it's the anti-white agenda, the degeneracy in our cultures. Similarly with this whole coronavirus thing, just the absolute propaganda and manufactured hysteria and just head-spinning social engineering, and which has been coercion that's been going on with all that. And now we're into these, you know, we're having, this is a serious discussion we're having over here now about these vaccine passports. And it's thoroughly depressing. But you can, that's Mark Collett. He's Patriotic Alternative. If you go to that website, you'll see, you get everything you need to know about Mark on there and the work he does. That's Patriotic Alternative. He's also, he does a podcast with David Duke. He's actually on the same network that I'm on. I'm on just before him with Richard Carey at 6 p.m. to 7 on Mondays on Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN. And you can catch Mark on there on Patrick Slattery's show, which is just after the show I'm on, or Richard Carey's show, Beyond the Official Narrative, that I co-host with Richard every Monday. So he's on there on a Monday at 7 p.m. till 8 p.m. UK time, which is 1 till 2 Central Time. You can catch him on there. And then he does his own live stream, which is Patriotic, I think it's Patriotic Weekly Review, if I'm correct. And as I say, he does a podcast with David Duke on a Friday, and Laura Tyler. So before further ado, I'll just crack on with that interview. It is about an hour long, and we covered a lot of good stuff on here. So, all right, I am live with Mark Collett. Mark is the founder of Patriotic Alternative. It's great to have you with me, Mark.
It's great to be with you again, Paul. I always enjoy it when we record together. And we're having a very interesting chat before we went live. And there's quite a lot to speak about at the moment, because obviously we're moving into a time where we were told we were going to be coming out of lockdowns. This year was meant to be something better. How many people on New Year's Eve were saying, I can't wait for 2020. This is going to be a much better year for us all. And here we are in 2020. And I've got to be honest, things 21. Are even worse. Sorry, 2021. People are saying 2021 is going to be even better than 2020. Yeah, yeah. It's got to be better than 2020. We've got to have a better year. You know, goodbye to that terrible year. But here we are in 2021. And things are, I've got to say, markedly worse already.
Yeah, because I think 2020, you know, the problem is a lot of people, and again, I don't want to, like, get into beating people, you know, around the head with, you know, pontificating too much, but the ignorance is off the chart. I mean, and the ground, of course, has been prepared with, you know, entertainment, football, soaps, you name it. And, you know, people actually believed that we were going to go into this lockdown, we would flatten the curve for 3 weeks and we'd come out of it and we should give away all our freedoms. But 2020 was literally just walking into the forest, which is a very dark, deep forest. So, I mean, it's been no surprise to me that 2021 is getting worse. And, you know, I think it's going to get a lot worse before it's going to get better. I mean, you're talking probably years.
Oh, I think it's going to get a lot, lot worse. And if you looked at the information that was coming out yesterday, what the government was saying, the new legislation, basically, there is this massive two-tier system they're building. One, tier four migrants who are more or less going to be allowed to come and go as they please, come and go freely, do as they wish. And one tier for normal, law-abiding British people. And the thing that amazed me in the last few days is the way they keep saying British nationals who are returning home from holidays will be forced to quarantine. They will be forced to stay in these hotels at their own cost.
And pay for it. £1,700.
Yeah, exactly. £1,700. But just down the road, you've got migrants housed in better quality hotels at the taxpayers' expense. And you're starting to look at all of this and you're saying, this is insane. They're not even hiding it anymore. They're openly saying, you guys are second-class citizens. Now, I knew people wouldn't be going on holiday. How did I know people weren't going to be going on holiday? Well, it's quite obvious. The reason people aren't going to be going on holiday is because who can afford, for a start, even if you took the financial aspect away from this, even if you said the financial stuff's not an issue, the government are going to pay for everyone to, everyone to stay in these hotels. So don't worry about that. The government's got you covered. Even if you said that, which they're definitely not saying, who could afford to take a 7-day break, come home, and then take an additional 10 days? Nobody. You wouldn't be able to work. You wouldn't be able to pass that with your boss. There would also be, even if the government paid for your hotels, there would still be associated costs with that. And you're looking at all of this, and it is so blatantly this double standard that we're talking about now. And this double standard is absolutely tilted against British nationals. So they're more or less saying you're not having a holiday. And on top of that, they're saying, and what's more, if you plan a holiday in this country, you're probably not going to be having that either. So this is absolute tyranny on a completely unprecedented level.
Yeah, it really is. And it also demonstrates, of course, that when the will's there, when it fits their agenda, they can bring in the policies to seriously restrict movement into the country. But as you say, it's very targeted at British nationals and citizens of the country, as opposed to, and I'm sure it'll be ongoing, that people will continue to come into this country illegally and blind eyes will be turned, as usual, as you say, at the expense of the taxpayer who resent their presence here, let alone paying for it. They will be put up in hotels and everything will be paid for, and they will live like kings compared to where they've come from, you know?
Definitely, definitely. Well, that is obviously part of all this, isn't it? They come here, they are handed everything on a plate, and then you have these complete midwits say, but why are they coming? I don't understand why they're all flocking to be. Well, of course they're flocking to be here. They're coming from parts of the world where there is literally nothing, really. There is nothing for them. And they're coming here, and they're getting to import their culture, their way of life, their entire extended family. And then everything's given to them on a plate. So they're not coming here to be British, are they? They're not coming here to fit in. They're coming here to bring a little bit of Pakistan, a little bit of Afghanistan, a little bit of Syria here to the UK. And we, the taxpayers, pay for this. We fund this. We hand it to them all on a plate. And these people are truly treated as first-class citizens. But I think this is going to get much worse. I mean, I've said this before many times on different shows. I don't think this is going to end with us being second-class citizens. This will end with white people in the United Kingdom being a hated minority.
Yeah, and I was saying that, yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the hatred is already there, you know, drummed up with the media. And, you know, if the demographic trends continue, we will be a minority in no time. And we're now seeing, you know, in the United States, we were talking off air about the social credit score. And with this domestic terrorism thing, I mean, literally, it's a purging operation where you have basically, you know, the comply to the status quo and those who are dissenters, and the institutions, the government, big tech, the corporations have literally declared war on the dissenter. You know, not even just white people, but just the wider net of like being a Trump supporter. And so we talked about this social credit score thing, and I thought it was quite fascinating what you're saying. If you could just touch on that, what you're saying about China, etc.
Well, I think the social credit system is very, very interesting because I've looked into what China are doing with their social credit system, and it seems to be some form of very crudely enforced good behavior. So if you live in China and you behave yourself, if you live in China and you're doing, let's say, good things, so you're helping old ladies across the street, you're doing your homework, you're not staying out late at night, you marry your childhood sweetheart, you're polite to people, you work hard, you stay at work and do a little bit of overtime when somebody called in sick, you get social credit. So this actually looks like an enforced system of essentially, for want of a better term, being a good person. If you're a good person, you get good social credit. You are looked after, the government smiles upon you, and ultimately you're treated well for basically behaving yourself. So if you act in a socially conscious manner, you get good social credit. That's essentially the system in a nutshell. And I find that maybe it's a little bit heavy-handed that they're trying to bring about good behavior via this system. But if you look at what the West are doing, the West are implementing or trying to implement through social networks, the big tech companies, through employment policies, a similar system of social credit. But their social credit system seems to be completely upturned. So when you look at the social credit system that, say, the British government or the US government would be looking at, it would be completely different to the Chinese social credit system. It wouldn't be giving you good social credit for being a traditionalist, for being a good person, for helping old ladies across the street, for staying in school. It would be giving you social credit for essentially being a criminal. If you were
a homosexual
or a homosexual or a deviant or something other than what you would actually think you would get social credit for. And this is what you're going to see. You're going to see a social credit system that is the same as the social credit systems that we've just discussed, but they're going to be inverted. So if you're a transgender, you know, good luck. You're going to get great, great social credit. If you're transgender, you're going to get wonderful social credit. You're going to be looked after. The government's going to smile upon you. But if you're a normal, decent, law-abiding person, who basically goes to church on a Sunday, wants a traditional upbringing for your children, believes in actual traditional British values, I can tell you this now, you are not going to be treated well. You'll be treated as a social pariah, and you will get negative social credit for actually being a good person. So you're going to see what you're seeing in China, but it's going to be implemented in a very, very different way. And the implementation is going to be almost the opposite. So whilst the Chinese are trying to incentivize people into engaging in a race to the top, our government will be incentivizing people into what could be likened as a race to the bottom. And that is going to be the big, big difference between, say, British social credit or Western social credit and Chinese social credit.
Yeah, and even though I think we both would agree, as you said, it's not really something, sort of a system that any of us would really desire to live under. At least with the Chinese, the intention there is you know, good in inverted commas. I mean, there's some logic to it. At least you can understand it. It's transparent, it's consistent, and it's designed to actually improve the country in some way. That is the intention, whether it's social harmony and cohesion or whatever. But it basically, it's not disingenuous, because our, as you say, our credit, social credit scores will be based on degeneracy and ultimately the destruction of the moral and spiritual and ethnic cohesion and cultures, and ultimately just this result in destruction.
Of course. And you can see that this is being engineered in such a way already. You already have a system where we as white people are second-class citizens just because of the color of our skin, unless, however, there is some exception. And when I say if there's some exception, an exception to that would be something along the lines that we were, say, a homosexual, or we were a communist, or there was something about us that went against normal, healthy, what would be seen as typically at one point in time British values. If you went against British values, or you were some kind of degenerate outlier, you will be seen as somebody who deserves immediate social credit under this new system.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I've joked with this before with friends, you know, and my son, that, you know, being a white male and being a Christian, you know, if I get in trouble, particularly, you know, if it's in the political or cultural commentary, which is, you know, possible because of my radio show, and you're standing in front of the judge, well, I'm in a lot of trouble unless I happen to say, but hold on a minute, I actually am a liberal Christian and I'm a homosexual. Then I might expect some leniency. My score is going to go up a little bit.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And you will see as well that the more of an outlier you are, the more score you'll get. And there used to be this joke. It used to be a joke, but now it's essentially true. People used to talk about this mythical one-legged black lesbian because she's got everything going for her. Yeah. She's black, she's female, she's a homosexual. And she's disabled, so she is top of the pecking order. Mm. And that is literally where we are headed. At one time, that would sort of be a joke that you would see in an edgy column on the Daily Mail, sort of satirizing the modern politically correct society. But this isn't satire anymore. This is actually where we are. This is how low we've gone. And I think this is not all by accident. This is another mistake that people make. I'm sure your listeners don't, but it's a mistake that sort of mainstream conservatives with a small C make. And I differentiate when I talk about conservatives between conservatives with a big C and conservatives with a small C. Obviously, yeah. Conservatives with a big C are ones that are firmly entrenched within the Conservative Party. And then there are conservatives with a small C who are people who just hold conservative values. And
whatever that is.
I was just going to say, the people who hold the small C conservatives have this massive, massive misunderstanding that somehow everything that's happening to this country has come about via accident.
Yeah.
It's not via malice. It's not via planning. It's by accident that all of these unfortunate things just happened. And they happened because good people made honest mistakes. And that is not the case. This is not a situation where good people are making honest, you know, good, honest people are making rather honest mistakes, trying to do the best thing. That is not the case. What we are seeing here is a absolute planned destruction of the Western world. And this is being done by people who call themselves conservative with a capital C. But if you actually look at these conservatives and what they have done since they have been in power, they have actually brought about more liberal, or progressive in inverted commas, changes to the UK than the Labour government ever did.
Yeah, because I mean, there's very, very little difference in them. I mean, they're all Marxist globalist types. They're all puppets. They say the right things to get into power, and then when they get into power, they go about, you know, doing what they really want to do and pleasing who they really want to please. And as you say, I mean, when my son was 12 years old, he's 17 now, he understood things more than most of these, you know, centrist types, even like the likes of Farage and these guys on talk radio, although I have seen some shifts on talk radio because of the coronavirus. But this idea that people are only ever well-intentioned and only ever make mistakes, and that governments always have our best interests at heart, I mean, it's so naive. You know, does no one study They never look at history. Do they think tyranny is just some sort of myth? But with that said, I have seen, you know, if you look at the likes of James Dillingpole and people like that, and people on talk radio, even Julia Hartley Brewer and some of these other guys, the evidence and the obvious manipulation and propaganda around the coronavirus deaths, hospitalizations, PCR tests, all of it has led them to conclude, because they're intelligent people, but, you know, it has led them to conclude that there's something more going on here. I mean, they're still trying to resist it, and they will still do whatever they can to fit this into their naive, childlike worldview. But it has smashed down barriers, and I think it has been a silver lining of this coronavirus, because the propaganda has been so blatant and so obvious and transparent, you know?
I agree. I think the coronavirus has been very, very interesting, because I've talked quite extensively about something I call the Donald Trump effect. But the Donald Trump effect hasn't just been confined to America. It's happening all over the world. Donald Trump helped to do something that I think was wonderful. He helped to polarize society. He helped to drag people in two different directions. So you saw the complete liberal, drooling, moronic, pro-degeneracy, pro-immigration type show their hand completely. Then on the other side, you saw nationalists, patriots, traditionalists showing their hand. And society at one point seemed to be going in the opposite direction. During the 90s, there seemed to be this race to capture the middle ground. There seemed to be this race to ensure that this sort of middle ground that almost mythical middle ground was captured. So the Tories were like, look, if we stand one step to the right of the middle ground, we'll capture everything to the right. And Labour were like, well, look, if we stand one step to the left of the middle ground, we will capture everything to the left of the middle ground. And that seemed to be a viable political strategy for both sides of the divide. And after that, things changed rather dramatically. And instead of this middle ground being the place all the politicians fought over, we're actually seeing the opposite of that. And we're seeing this absolutely huge polarization. And this polarization is continuing very, very quickly. And the coronavirus has, I think, played into this polarization. It's had a massive, massive effect, because it simply can't be ignored, can it? The coronavirus is something that's in your face every day. And if you even have an ounce of mental faculty, you straight away realize what you're being told is garbage. You don't have to have much about you to realize that. It's just very, very, very obvious. And it goes to every part of your life. I mean, I see people, I know plenty of people who talk about coronavirus, normal people, and they all say the same thing. Well, if it was a real pandemic, bodies would be piling up in the street. I only know two people have been ill and they got over it. And I don't know anyone that's died. I hear that all the time from people. I see people who are saying, but why are we wearing these masks? You know, when you go to a GP surgery at Christmas and it's flu season, you've never seen GPs wearing masks before. Well, they're exposed to loads of people. Why are we wearing the masks? And none of it adds up. And then they'll say, didn't they tell us at the beginning masks actually make things worse? Oh, yeah, they did, didn't they? Masks make things worse. Now, masks fix everything. And once you start going down this rabbit hole, it's very, 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 very obvious to anyone who's got any sort of functioning brain that this is all a load of nonsense. And when you see politicians coming out on television, on the radio, and they are on a daily basis contradicting themselves, which they are. These people are absolutely contradicting themselves on a daily basis about different things. And people are now starting to see that there is this massive, massive disruption to everybody's lives. There is this massive, massive, unbelievable damage to people's businesses. Yet are we really saving lives? And the answer is no, because the press have actually been quite honest about this. We aren't saving lives. We aren't actually doing anything good. In fact, if you look at the statistics on deaths, last year in England, just 388 people died of coronavirus. Now, that's nothing. Yet, when you're looking at people who've died because of effects of the lockdown, you're actually getting to a point now where more people are dying because of the effects of the lockdown, and people's health is declining at a greater rate because of the effects of the lockdown than there are people dying or declines in health due to coronavirus. So you've got something that's being posed as a cure to this great problem, yet the cure that is being proposed is far more deadly than the disease itself.
Oh, absolutely. All the, you know, cancer scans, operations, all the other operations, as you talked about, the you know, the effect on people's psyches and just their, you know, their spirit, enthusiasm, the children. There was no cost benefit analysis done on this at all. And these scientists are, I mean, some of these people aren't even scientists. Some of them are sort of behavioral scientists. There's a wrote her name down, but one of them, one of the advisors to Johnson, is actually a member of the British Communist Party. She's a behavioral psychologist. She's not a epidemiologist or a virologist or any of these things. And yeah, there's just been complete disregard for the wider picture. And the reality is, by what the government's done, the real crisis is coming down the tracks. It's a societal one, and it's a economic one, and that's the real crisis that no one really talks about. And yet there's just this absolute obsession on something which has been a created crisis. Because I mean, they used to figure 100,000, but those deaths are recorded for anyone who tested positive for coronavirus within, you know, or died within 28 days of a positive test. And that means if I tested positive 27 days ago for coronavirus, walked out in the street and got hit by a lorry and killed, that's recorded as a coronavirus death.
Oh, of course. And this is the insanity. And when you actually, I'd love to pull this up to get the actual wording correct, because I remember putting this out on my Telegram. I'm just going to flip through my Telegram and my files and actually try to find this, because I think it's actually very, very important. So I can read you the actual headline, because I made a video last week called "Lockdowns Kill More People Than COVID." And that's obviously a very, very interesting topic. Here it is. This is Sky News. And this was, I believe it was a tweet or an update or a status from Sky News. Breaking: more than 100,000 people in the UK have died after catching coronavirus. Well, that says everything that you need to know, doesn't it? But to the average person who isn't reading between the lines, who isn't studying that carefully, the average person is unfortunately going to see that, and the average person is going to say, wow, it's over 100,000 now. And in fact, it's not over 100,000. In fact, Sky News are telling you everything you need to know in that headline. Yes, 100,000 people have died, but those 100,000 people who have died are people who have tested positive at one time or another for coronavirus. Yeah. But, and this is the incredible thing, they were also pulling another scam a few months ago where they were saying the rate of coronavirus infections were going through the roof. You know, the rate of coronavirus infections were growing so incredibly. And what were we all going to do? But a few days before, and these ministers must think we're complete idiots, because a few days before, the same newspapers were reporting the following: the government is aiming to increase the number of people being tested for coronavirus by 10. What? Yeah. So you're timesing the number of tests tenfold. Then a few weeks later, you're crying that the number of COVID cases is going through the roof. Well, if I test 10 times the sample number of people for a cold, odds on, I'm going to get roughly 10 times as many people with colds. It's as simple as that.
Exactly.
And they're doing this And they're telling us that they're doing it. And a lot of people, despite being told that they're doing it, are falling for it. But this goes back to what I was saying earlier about the polarization in society. Unfortunately, there are people who want to believe that this is terrible. The left love this. Liberals love this. And these clowns, these complete weirdos and freaks, they actually enjoy having their liberties taken away. And if you actually see the way they've reacted to this, they are literally wetting themselves with absolute excitement at the prospect of the government taking away more of people's liberties. So when you see these people, it's like back at the time of Brexit, you might remember every complete dribbling, lobotomized liberal midwit changed their profile picture on Facebook or Twitter to be a European flag, them holding a European flag, something to do with the European flag. It was almost like if you wanted to avoid your local drooling moron, avoid the person who had just changed their profile picture to them holding the European flag. And you would guarantee that would be a good way of screening people. Now, all you have to do is avoid the people who have just changed their profile pictures to them wearing a mask. Because wearing the mask is basically the new flag, isn't it? It's the new little European flag on the profile picture. And they're so proud of the fact they're wearing the mask, aren't they? They're so absolutely in love with it.
Yeah, it goes down to this sort of virtue signaling thing. I mean, it's like their drug of choice, their moral superiority. They get high on their own moral superiority and they're constant this moral high ground grab, and it really is like a drug to them. But it is fascinating. It didn't take too long before you saw that dichotomy again, that polarization. You know, you had it with Brexit, you have it in America with Trump and those who hate Trump, which is everybody apart from Trump supporters. And, you know, and here with the lockdowns, as I said, it didn't take long before you had those who are pro-lockdown, pro-masks, and the rest of us. And it fitted into almost that same kind of category, your average. Not exactly. There are some nuances to it as well, because it's quite interesting that a lot of the Muslims seem to be against lockdowns and masks and that type of thing. But, you know, generally speaking, it was this divide again, you know, parallel, there's symmetry between, you know, those who want to stay in the EU and those who want to leave. And I just don't understand, you know, their mindset. I don't understand the mindset of the James O'Briens of this world. You know, that kind of guy sort of embodies this sort of thing, where they just seem to love people's freedoms being taken away, being ruled by large bureaucratic systems, with big governments, tyranny, telling you what you can do. I mean, do these people ever make any decisions for themselves? Do they, you know, if the government decided they, you know, to tell them what time they should brush their teeth at night, it's like they would go along with it. You know, it's like they're children. And to another extent, I think they're so miserable. You know, misery needs company. They're the type of people that are busybodies. They like interfering in people's lives. They're like imposing themselves on people. They've got, you know, they're so unhappy and they're just full of resentment and anger. They just have to be making everyone else miserable, you know?
Well, James O'Brien is a particularly obnoxious man. And he is somebody. He's absolutely talentless. He has no opinions of his own. He's never come up with any theories or interesting ideas. He is just the guy who wants to be the most shouty, the most aggressive proponent of whatever garbage is currently being pushed at this point in time. So if at the moment it's masks, he wants to be Mr. Mask. He'd be the sort of person that if it's masks, if that is it, that, you know, at the moment it is mask time, he is Mr. Mask. And he is so proud of his mask and he loves wearing his mask and he'll wear two masks. And if he drives to the supermarket, he drives to the supermarket in his mask. So when he gets out of the car, everyone can see him wearing the mask. He loves it, doesn't he?
He's just a mask with legs and arms.
He is. But not only does he want to be the mask, with arms and legs scuttling about the supermarket car park. He actually wants everyone else to be, and he wants to be the guy that when you say, you know what, I'm not too sure about this whole mask malarkey, maybe this is all just total trash, I'm not too sure about this, mate. Wants to be the guy that runs up to you and feels absolutely morally justified screaming in your face and calling you a threat to safety, because that's how he's painting, that's how his ilk are painting it, isn't it? That if you are the guy that is skeptical of mask wearing,
you've
then
got blood on your hands.
Yeah, you've got blood. You've got grandma's blood on your hands. You were the guy that murdered Captain Tom. You know, if you don't wear your mask, you might as well have loaded up a gun and shot Captain Tom in the back of the head, because that's how much respect you've got for our society, and you're probably a threat to democracy as well. That is literally, how they're playing this.
Yeah, well, it is a psyops operation from the government as well, because they know that they can put this out there and then let the people police it. I mean, as a principal, I haven't worn a mask ever going to any of the supermarkets. Now, I'm fortunate that I live pretty near a Tesco, and I tend to go up there, maybe at 9 or half 9. I mean, I normally go up to those supermarkets before all this, when it's quiet anyway, because there's less crowds. And they've generally left me alone, although over the last, since Christmas and since this new sort of up in the ante on it, they've got these guys and these security guys. And so now you have to say you've got an exemption. And then, some of them might push you on that, or they might not, depending. But, it's like, talk about corrupt governments making criminals of law-abiding citizens. Now going to a supermarket, just something as innocuous as that, without wearing a mask, is against the law, unless you can say, I've got an exemption. And some of them will push it, depending on how personally tyrannical they are. But the law hasn't changed. I mean, you don't have to show proof that you've got an exemption. But, just even going to the supermarket now is like a kind of a political statement. It's kind of draining, but I won't give in to it, because I really do think that the mask is a visible appearance of compliance. And I wish that all the people who don't agree with the masks, I wish, because there was a poll done when they first came out in the summer when there was no virus. And I think something like 45% people said they were happy to wear them, but 40% people said they weren't happy to wear them, but they would wear them anyway. And that's the group that I've got a problem with. If you don't think, and a lot of these guys, on talk media, and these people, they wear the masks, just don't wear them. Because if you had 40% and then the other 18%, I think it was, people said they would refuse to wear it, if that becomes 58% of people not wearing masks, they can't police that. They can't even police it for a dozen people, because the police aren't going to police it. And it's very frustrating to me that more people will just, because people, when you see someone with a mask, that might be someone who really disagrees with the mask, but you can't tell that. All you can see is there's another little compliant robot, quite frankly.
I completely agree. I think that I would love to see people not wearing the mask. Now, I'll be honest, there are two places where I have worn masks if I've been sort of asked to. One is the supermarket, not because I'm sort of cooking on anything, but because I can't get kicked out of my local supermarket. That is one thing I just can't do. Because if I get kicked out of the local supermarket, that affects not just me, but it affects
my family
as well. Yeah. So that's one place. And the other place is the post office, because I have to go to the post office and I have to send things. And that's a business. But everywhere else, including other shops, I have worn, I've not worn the mask, and but I've got into arguments with people, and I've got into arguments with people over bizarre things. I recounted this story before on other shows, but I was going into a shop near me. I was there with Mrs. Mark and little Sophia, and we were heading into this shop. And they'd set up one of these stations where you have to use your hand sanitizer. And this old guy, he was hand sanitizing like it was a religion. And I was like, I'm not putting on the hand sanitizer. We don't need the hand sanitizer. We're just nipping in for something and we're coming out. And me, the family, we said, right, just grab the trolley. We're flying past. We're getting in. We're getting out. So that's what we did. But on our way in, one guy started shouting at us. Oh, there's a queue for some of us, you know, mate. What? No, there's a queue for the hand sanitizer that we're choosing not to use. Mm. So it's none of your business if we walk past you. I'm not stood here to queue because I want to wait any longer so I can see you put on your hand sanitizer, buddy. I'm off. So off we went past, and he just kept on shouting like an absolute buffoon. But to him, he was absolutely morally justified to have a go at myself, my missus, my child who was there.
Yeah.
This to him was something that he thought was absolutely 100% okay. He didn't see any wrong in doing what he was doing. He thought it was completely fine, and he was ready to more or less get into a confrontation with two people simply because they were going about their business and they had chosen not to put on the hand sanitizer. And at the moment, as you know, and as your listeners will know, hand sanitizer isn't a requirement. It isn't a requirement that you chuck this alcohol gel all over your hands every time you go anywhere. That is, no one said that that's a requirement, but that was the hill he wanted to die on. He wanted to get into a confrontation with somebody over that, because there's something about the British people that always bothers me, and that is that they seem so compliant up and above other groups of people.
Yeah,
so
I would agree with that. I've thought about that as well. We were talking about that quite recently, actually. Yeah.
So if there's a queue,
they'll join it.
They will. And and on our way out, I said to my missus, I said, look, I says, if we stop, because she was going on about it and saying what an idiot this guy was. And I said, look, we could stop by that tree up ahead and just stand there on the pavement, and people would start queuing behind us. And if anyone tried to walk past us, there'd be somebody in the queue that would jump out, have a go at them, and tell them, you don't have a right to pass that tree. There's a queue for people who want to walk past that tree. And that's that kind of herd mentality that we've had drummed into us. And it's really worrying, because these are people that, you know, we need to appeal to. We need to ultimately try and get on board. We need to try and, you know, win over in some respect. But winning them over is just ludicrously difficult.
Yeah,
because they're committed to just following the herd, even if they're following the herd to their own slaughter.
Yeah, because in more that phenomenon you're talking about, in more normal and harmless times, it is more harmless. You can look at it, you can observe it. It might irritate you a bit. It might not, whatever. But when that's weaponized, that's dangerous. And that's what we're seeing. I mean, there's, you know, when this first came out, there's a lot of people not only falling for it, but calling for it. And there's still a lot of people who want these lockdowns. And I think a lot of people, of course, in the public sector who aren't getting affected financially, people who are being furloughed, who are getting paid with, which is essentially glorified welfare at this stage, because, you know, this is a joke. This is a facade. Those companies that were, you know, a lot of those companies aren't going to be there, let alone the jobs. But yeah, I mean, there's still people who seem to want these lockdowns without giving any thought to the larger societal and economic implications of this. I mean, there's a huge wealth transfer going on in the West today and through this coronavirus. And if we're not careful, I mean, the amount of money we're printing up, you know, so we're increasing the national debt. We've got over 2 trillion now in the UK. And simultaneously, we're destroying the tax base. And, you know, this is kind of, if this keeps going at the rate it's going, we're going to turn, you know, the UK into kind of a more kind of Argentina type country, because that can happen. You know, the public services start to crumble, the roads start to crumble, the taxes will have to go through the roof, and we'll find a very, very different country when we come out of this woods that I talked about, that we only just went into last year, you know.
Well, look, it's very interesting you say that. And I've been saying this to people as well. I could actually talk all night about this, because there are a lot of powerful, I'm not going to talk all night about it, but I could, because there's a lot of powerful forces here which are acting on people. And I'll give you an example of these powerful forces. If you look at normal people, let's say you're on, £40,000 a year. Okay, that's a, you know, a decent wage. You're on 40 grand a year. Now, if you're on 40 grand a year, you're probably going to be, if you're furloughed, you're £40,000 a year. And if you're furloughed, you're going down to £32,000 a year. So that's 8 grand drop. But over a year, how much do you spend on petrol? How much do you spend on lunches? You probably spend 35 quid a week.
Holidays, weekends that you can't go to.
Yeah. All of these things you would be spending on. So you probably spend 2 grand on your lunches going to work. You probably spend 40 quid a week on petrol, getting to work or commuting. So there,
Jim,
you've got 4 grand there that you've just spent. So really, once you take out your work-based costs, getting to work, eating, like you say, going to the gym on the way home, all the other stuff, you start to actually see that all of a sudden you're getting you're not furloughed for 80% because you don't have as many costs going out anymore. In fact, in real terms, you know, you're only getting paid maybe 35, 36 grand a year in effect, but now you're getting paid 32. So you're 3 grand worse off a year for zero work. And all of a sudden, you've got a very, very powerful incentive for normal people never to want to go back into the workplace, for this
exactly.
to go on and on.
Exactly.
And if you're really honest about this, there is a real, real chance that lots of people will back further restrictions for financial reasons, because there are an awful lot of people who are living very well. And it's not just the people that I'm talking about now either. I don't know if you saw the headline in the Daily Mail the other week where Lord Falconer, he's a member of the Labour Party. I think he's he's something to do with finance. I can't remember his exact position, but he went to a meeting with these big city solicitors and the money men, and he was speaking there on behalf of Labour. And this is a direct quote. He said, "Coronavirus for you guys is the gift that keeps on giving." He said, "You guys are making more money than you've ever made before." So on one hand, you've got the people at the top. They're making huge, huge amounts of money. Then on the other hand, you've got people who are furloughed, and they're making maybe not huge amounts of money, but they are sat at home. And for the first time, probably ever, they're making huge sums of money for doing nothing. They're getting basically just under a full-time wage, and they're doing nothing. And that leaves us in the UK in a situation where the super rich are going to love it, so they're going to push for it. The average guy on the street is probably enjoying it, especially if they are young adults who are single. So if you're a single man, or if you're a guy with a girlfriend and you live together, and you're both furloughed and you sat at home, well, she's sat watching TV all day, he's sat watching Call of Duty all day. You come together in the evening, watch box sets, eat takeaway pizza, and life is sweet, isn't it?
Yeah, because you're getting paid. You might, as I say, with all those things that you're saving, you might get the calculator out and work out that you're actually up more than what you otherwise would have been, because you're out of harm's way. I mean, I remember when I worked down in London, you know, I'd come out of the office, we would go for, you know, for a couple of beers at 5:30. I'd still be in there at 9:30. And
yes,
I spent 60 quid, not the 15 that I intended to spend. So you might actually end up with more money. And I mean, it's perverse incentives all over the place, almost to the point where it's just like you've got the central banks in collusion with the governments, basically bribing people for this whole wealth transfer and the restructuring of society. Because The debt is so big now. You look at America's debt. I mean, it's just like, it's laughable. So they're never going to, I don't think they're ever going to be able to raise the taxes. And we'll probably end up, you know, I think this is deliberate. Well, they'll say, well, we couldn't really deal, you know, it came out of left field, this coronavirus thing. We had to furlough everybody. We had to print up all these billions. But you know what? We're not going to raise the taxes because it's just going to make everyone's life miserable, and they'll just inflate the debt away. They'll just keep printing and inflate the debt away, which will lead to the great reset stuff that people are talking about. It'll be, an economic great reset coupled with this global restructuring of society, where all this cultural Marxist stuff, diversity, equality, all these buzzwords of sustainability will come into play. And the central banks are already talking about digital currencies. And then this feeds into the social credit score, where people, what they're doing is creating mass dependency. It's also leading to this UBI phenomenon. But the problem is, it is dependency. And so if your credit, universal credit, or your credit score, social credit score isn't up to scratch, well, they can just turn off the tap, and you can find yourself not just a pariah, but a homeless pariah.
You can, and this is the big problem. You are moving into a situation here in the UK where people are going to be absolutely dependent on the state for furlough or for universal basic income, or whatever it's called, or whatever it will end up being called. And these people will depend on the state to the point where they have to be absolutely compliant, because they know damn well that if they're not compliant, the state can just pull the rug out from under their feet. And what we're also facing as well, which is an interesting effect of all of this, is, and I believe this is absolutely intentional, is the government is trying to destroy, and I'm not a big drinker, but the government is absolutely trying to destroy the pub trade. It's trying to destroy pubs. And I think that that's, again, I think that's by design. I think they're trying to destroy anywhere where normal white guys go and meet and discuss issues that might be difficult for the system. So the system...
There could be seeds of dissent sown in the pub once people have a couple of pints in them and start to express what they're really thinking.
Exactly. And I remember, this was some time ago now, but I remember when I was in the British National Party, all of our local meetings, with a few exceptions, the vast majority, should I say, of local meetings seemed to be held in pubs. And it was a place where people came together to talk about what was affecting them. And it was almost like that was where the common man got involved in politics. And the last thing they want right now is the common man being involved in any way in politics. They want the common man out of politics, not thinking, sat at home, watching his box sets, enjoying his lockdown.
And thinking he's on his own with the thoughts he has.
Yes, exactly. Being too, and eventually, with this social credit system, the common man will be too scared to actually say anything. The common man will just be like, well, I can't really say anything. It's not worth it. I'm not getting involved. I'm not coming off the bench. I'm not doing anything that really ever puts at risk my social credit score, which puts at risk my income, my UBI. I'm just going to sit here, accept it, watch another box set, order another pizza. I'm good. And I'll keep my head down. And that'll be left then to people like myself and other people who stick their head above the parapet to keep doing so. But we're already social pariahs. Only this week, I lost my Facebook and Instagram, which I didn't really use for politics at all. My Instagram was mainly pictures of family events, baking, my daughter. But that's been taken away from me, not because I violated terms and conditions, but because of who I am.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a very interesting point. I remember saying that very thing last year. The pub is a place for ideas. It's also, both in Britain and Ireland, it is a place where people get together. And after a couple of drinks, those guys, there's a guy I work with, and he's a bit like, he's your average kind of sort of almost sort of just lower middle class guy. And, because I work with him every day, and thankfully my job is not something which is likely to be too easily targeted by the powers that be. But he says to me that you say what a lot of us are thinking. It's just you just say it, and the pub is a place where there's a kind of a spirit in the British pub and in the Irish pub where the working man comes and shares ideas, shares his frustrations, and can get organized a bit, because there's that kind of bonding and that sort of safety in numbers thing that goes on in a pub. And when people do get a couple of pints, you know, the guys, I talk to these guys, sometimes I've got a reasonable sense. I'll say a couple of things to see how someone responds, you know, and then you can push it further. Before you know it, the guy's like exploding with a rant, and then he sort of catches, and then he catches himself. And there are plenty of those guys out there, and you will find them in the pub if you could go there. And I think, you know, I agree with you. It is completely deliberate that the pubs have been targeted so, so heavily. And when you look back, Mark, probably even the smoking ban and all the pressure that they've put on pubs over the years, it's probably been deliberate as well, because they've had this, you know, encroaching Marxist oppression, you know, for it's been happening now for, what, 30, 40 years, just incrementally and then exponentially over the last sort of 5 years.
Well, I would say the biggest thing, I've heard people say that about the smoking ban before, but the smoking ban was something that, especially in restaurants, was something I actually supported. One thing I hated was going to like pubs and restaurants and ending getting a face full of smoke because I don't smoke. But one thing I found did more damage to pubs than anything was it was twofold. Firstly, it was massive, massive duty being put on drinks. Now, this is going to make me sound like a very old man, but when I was in my 20s, I used to love going out in Leeds. And you could go out in Leeds and have a cracking Saturday night for less than £30. And you'd have some food. We used to live just outside the city centre. We'd walk in. We'd have a few drinks around bars. We'd go to a club. We'd come back. We'd get like some food on the way home, some chips or whatever. And you'd head back, you'd have a great night, and you'd have a couple of quid left from 30 quid, and it would be a good night out. Now, you're lucky if you'd get change from £100. So your prices of drinks have gone sky high because the government has forced them sky high. But at the same time, there has never, ever been as much cheap booze available in supermarkets. So what they're saying is, and this is the latest crap from the government, is that what they're going to do is stop people drinking in pubs. So you're going to be able to go to the pub, but they won't be allowed to sell alcoholic drinks. So really, it defeats really the point of going.
Just go to a restaurant.
Exactly. But the point is, and this is the incredible thing about this, you will still be able to get absolutely smashed at home for a fraction of the price you would have been able to get smashed in the pub. And I've seen this over the last 15 years or so of my life. And it's driven people not to drink less, but to drink in an isolated, sterile, home-based environment.
Atomized, demoralized, hopeless sort of environment.
Exactly. So you're not drinking and getting fired up and saying, come on, Paul, we've had enough, let's get something organized. You sat at home alone going,
Yeah, and sending the profits of Tesco and the big supermarkets through the roof and, you know, killing the pub. So there's quite a few stones killed with that, really.
Yeah, there is. And you know, people might listen to this and say, God, listen to these cranks and their conspiracies. But it is a conspiracy. It's not a conspiracy theory. Mm. It's a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy against our people. It's a conspiracy to destroy systems that were built up over hundreds and hundreds of years that underpinned our community and that helped us as a people organize in darker times. And now we're in darker times and we can't organize because those systems are being broken down and the places we used to organize are being taken away from us.
Yeah, how has it affected Patriotic Alternative? And just before we wrap up, I mean, for me this year, I have learned a lot. I mean, it's just been a fascinating sort of last 12 months. How has this whole last year affected your worldview, if at all? And what have you learned?
Well, it's affected Patriotic Alternative in a massive way because it means we can't hold our tentpole events. Now, when we were holding these big conferences, the first conference, we had 100 people there. We sold it out. Everyone had a great time. The second conference.
100,000?
Sorry, 100 people.
Oh, I thought you said 100,000. Okay.
No, 100 people. Sorry. Okay. We had 100 people at our first conference and we sold it out. And it was fantastic. And it was something that raised everybody's morale. The second conference, we almost doubled those numbers. And it was the weekend before the lockdown came into force. So we would have easily got over 200. But people were at the time quite worried that it might have all been real. So we were really absolutely going fantastic, great guns for this. This was going to be, you know, this was like there was a revolutionary spirit in the air with all of this. Yeah,
some momentum.
Exactly. And what's actually happened here is it's not completely stripped us of any momentum. We still have plenty of things going on, and we are doing everything we can to push back against this lockdown. But what we are actually seeing is we're not holding those big events which boost everyone's morale. You'd see this massive boost in interest after one of our big conferences because people would be like, wow, it was a brilliant weekend. I've met new friends. I'm fired up. I want to do more. I want to get involved. I want to be, you know, if I didn't want to be off the bench before, I certainly do now. That was the mentality of people after these events. And to kill these events is to damage us. But how's it changed my worldview? Well, my worldview hasn't really changed at all. But what has changed is I am now looking at what's going on. And I'm saying to myself, were we prepared for this? Because I would say more has changed in the last 12 months, politically and socially, than I've ever seen change really before in any 12-month period. These changes have been incredible. And when you're looking at something like that happening, you've got to say to yourself, this is rapid. The political scene is changing around us to such a degree with such swiftness. It's actually hard to keep up with it. And this doesn't demoralize me. This isn't something that gets me down, but it is something that I'm absolutely acutely aware of.
Yeah, I thought the same thing, that, you know, even though to some extent we've been predicting this, you know, I've been in live radio for 5 years, and, you know, so we've got our head in this stuff all the time. But yeah, I mean, it took me by surprise. It's just a breakneck speed of it. It did take a while, just a couple of weeks where you're like, your head's just working overtime and you're thinking, you know, you're looking at the dominoes and you're looking, where's this going? You know, it took a while to sort of process that, you know, what they're doing and how they are accelerating programs and how it's all interwoven and so intrinsically linked with so many different tentacles and the idea that there's not a conspiracy at work. Well, this is one seriously coordinated accident, you know?
Well, one thing I would say about this, and this is something that I'm absolutely aware of, is when this happened, it was very hard to call initially what was happening, because a lot of the information coming out of China was that this was genuinely a massive, massive threat, and that this was something that could really be something nasty. This could be a genuine threat to us. And I think what caught a lot of people off guard was when something like that happens, you don't want to be too bullish about it. You don't want to be like, well, it doesn't matter, sod it.
Yeah, you want to err on the side of caution in case you and your family should end up dying and maybe like 2 million people will die or something, you know?
Well, you know, that's an interesting figure you just gave there, 2 million, because when they first started talking about coronavirus hitting the UK, Boris Johnson was saying somewhere between 70-80% would get it, and the death toll would end up being between about 2.4 million. That was his figures. He was saying that those people would get it, and this was the mortality rate. And I remember turning round to Mrs. Mark and saying to her, if he's right, if that's our mortality rate, if that's how many people are going to catch it, we're going to end up with 2.4 to 4 million people dead. And I said, if that happens, that's going to be absolutely world changing. That's going to be off the scale in terms of, geopolitical change in this country. And obviously, you have to err on the side of caution with anything like that. But I mean, now, you know, a year down the line, we know, you know, you can say absolutely conclusively that those aren't the figures. That isn't what that's not what's happening. But at the time, it did look very worrying. And China did lock down hard initially. But interestingly, you look at what's happening in China now, and you go to Wuhan, and there's outdoor concerts, life's back to normal. And
they've got freedom, and we're like how we portray China.
Well, this is a thing. This is a lovely show, because we've sort of gone full circle now, and we're dovetailing back to the very beginning of where we started. And this is what you've got. You know, you're talking about these social credit systems, and you're talking about China, you're talking about these big bad guys abroad. But ultimately, the Chinese, they have a better system of social credit. They have a system of social credit which would, you can actually see advancing. Because, you know, if you've got kids at school, why not have a system that actually rewards good kids who help old ladies with their shopping and things like that? What is wrong with that? That nothing. We used to have a system of social credit in this country. It wasn't actually formalized, but it was just a moral framework, so good people were rewarded. So China have got this decent moral framework, and bizarrely, they've actually got more rights.
It's like things have just been turned on their head, and I think we're in a much worse situation here, you know, generally, economically, morally, in terms of liberties than China. But anyway, okay, we'll wrap it up there. Mark, great as always to speak to you. And anybody listening, you can check out Mark Collette at Patriotic Alternative. You can go on the website there, and hopefully we will you know, have these lockdowns removed, and we can all start to get together again. Because I was hoping to go to one of the meetings myself, Mark, before all this happened. But as I say, hopefully we can get back there again, you know.
Oh, you'd be more than welcome. It'd be fantastic to see you there. And I've really, really enjoyed the show. So thank you so much for inviting me on.
All right, Mark, take care. All right, we ran over a little bit there, but that was Mark Collette from Patriotic Alternative. As I say, you can also catch him on Republic Broadcasting Network with Patrick Slattery, 7 p.m. UK time, 1 p.m. Central time. But I'll leave it there. As I say, we've run over. Thank you very much for tuning in, and I will be back again on Monday myself on Richard Carey's show, the Beyond Official Narrative. That's midday Central time, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. live here from London. So that's Monday, and then back here again on Revision Media on Wednesday, 8 p.m. UK, 2 p.m. Central. So until then, hope you enjoyed the interview. Take care and God bless.